Welcome to the Right Turn Radio Podcast. I'm John Cohan.
And I'm Abby Dean.
And you're listening to New England's foremost addiction and mental health program. Abby, tonight we're talking about meditation, taming that voice in your head.
Or those voices.
I have many.
Yes.
And we'll talk about that as well. Our guest tonight is award-winning ABC correspondent Dan Harris. Dan is co-anchor of Nightline and a weekend anchor on Good Morning America. He's the author of a new book, 10% Happier, How I Tamed the Voice in My Head, Reduced Stress Without Losing My Edge, and found self-help that actually works, a true story. Dan joins us on the phone from New York. Welcome to Right Turn Radio, Dan.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
And we have Dr. Mark Albanese, the Medical Director of Addictions at Cambridge Health Alliance, and on the faculty of Harvard Medical School's Division on Addictions. Dr. Albanese is also a clinical professor at Harvard, and he wrote a book, and that's kind of why he's here, called Understanding Addiction as Self-Medication, Finding Hope Behind Pain. Welcome, Mark.
Thank you for having me.
So I love the topic of this book because it's two things near and dear to my heart. It's the journey of, you know, learning to quiet that voice or learning to be present in the world and learning, you know, this is a universal story.
That's what I think. I mean, I was sitting at lunch as we were talking about this and everybody's like, oh, it was so nice when he was addressing the voices and the critical voices in our head or the you know, people who are constantly commenting on us and criticizing. It's not like somebody saying, great job. John, you did it again.
But I had it happen to me last night. I had a gig last night. And I played the drums and I hadn't picked up a pair of drumsticks in a month. And I thought I was horrible. That wasn't the feedback I got from the people in the audience or the band members. But I couldn't enjoy the evening until after we had played, until after I had a chance. And I meditate and do all those things. But I had that voice saying, you're horrible. And there was other drummers in the audience, so it made it even worse. I was self-critical. No one is thinking about me. No one is looking at me going, that wasn't the correct groove on that song. But that became my narrative. So, Dan, this is I love this book. I think coming to this, you know, your journey for finding help with this started in a very public and painful moment. Can you kind of set the stage for us about why you went on this journey and how you found meditation in the long run? What happened to you that made you think about this journey?
Well, I had a panic attack on national television in 2004. I was anchoring the news updates on Good Morning America. Because I'm a masochist, I asked our research department to find out how many people were watching. And according to the Nielsen ratings, there were 5.019 million people watching.
But so, who's counting?
No big deal. And the newsreader is the person who comes on at the top of the hour and reads the headlines. And back in 2004, that job was done by a woman named Robin Roberts, who's now the main host of the show. And I was filling in for her on this day in June of 2004. And I had done that job before, so I didn't have any reason to foresee what was about to happen. But a couple seconds into my shtick, I lost the ability to breathe, and I basically freaked out and had to quit in the middle, and it was extremely embarrassing.
Could you read the passage from page 2 that I think wonderfully kind of describes the moment?
Yeah, here we go. As I began the third story about cholesterol drugs, I was starting to lose my ability to speak, gasping as I waged an internal battle against the wave of howling terror, all of it compounded by the knowledge that the whole debacle was being beamed out live. You're on national television. This is happening now, right now. Everyone is seeing this, dude. Do something. Do something. I tried to fight through it with mixed results. The official transcript of the broadcast reflects my descent into incoherence. Researchers report people who take cholesterol-lowering drugs called statins for at least 5 years may also lower their risk for cancer, but it's too early to prescribe statins slowly for cancer production. It was at this point, shortly after my reference to cancer production, with my face drained of blood and contorted with ticks, that I knew I had to come up with something drastic to get myself out of the situation. And that's the section.
I think that's a wonderful description of a panic attack. Mark, what happens in a panic attack? What is going on in somebody's life?
I think a couple of things. One is, unless you've had a panic attack, I think it's very hard to imagine what it must be like, because you really, and I don't want to, I feel like the expert is Dan,
yep.
But, you know, my understanding is you really, you know, your body goes into this kind of out of control fight or flight kind of stance. And, you know, patients and other people I've known who have described them to me talk about how you really do feel like you're gonna die.
Yeah.
And that there's no way out.
Now this doesn't happen in a vacuum. Dan, tell us kind of what had happened the years before the panic attack, because there is a story.
Yeah, there's definitely a story. So I had joined ABC News as a pretty young guy after many years working in Boston and in Maine in local news. So I got to ABC News when I was 28, and I was really green. In fact, they took a picture of me on my first day for my security ID, which, despite 14 years of begging, they have not removed from my security ID. And you can see like how young and terrified I look. As actually, one of my colleagues has joked that if you take a wide shot of that picture, it looks like I might be holding a balloon. I was really young, you know, but by comparison to the people I was working with, at age 28, I was working with, you know, Peter Jennings and Barbara Walters and Diane Sawyer, and my way of compensating for my insecurity was to become a workaholic, and I threw myself into the job. And after I arrived in April of 2000, and so not long after I arrived, a year or so after I arrived, 9/11 happened, and I raised my hand to go cover the ensuing conflicts overseas, really without thinking much about the psychological consequences, and ended up spending many, many years in places like Afghanistan and Pakistan and Israel and the West Bank and Gaza, and made 6 trips to Iraq.
Wow.
When I got home from one of particularly long trip in Iraq, I got depressed. And, you know, somewhat embarrassingly, I didn't actually know I was depressed, although I was exhibiting what I now know to be some of the signs of depression. I was, you know, having trouble getting out of bed. I felt like I had a low-grade fever all the time. And I did a toweringly stupid thing at this juncture, which is I started to self-medicate with recreational drugs, including cocaine and ecstasy. I hasten to add that it wasn't like the Wolf of Wall Street or anything like that. It was not smart, but it wasn't, you know, stereotypical rock bottom.
You were trying to get relief.
Yes. I thought I was just having a good time. And I wasn't doing it every day. It was pretty sporadic, never when I was working, definitely not when I was on the air. But after the panic attack, I went to a doctor who was an expert in panic here in New York City, and he asked me a series of questions. One of them was, do you do drugs? And when I said yes, he kind of leaned back in his chair and gave me a look that said, okay, jerk face, mystery solved.
That was dumb.
And so, you know, he explained that even though I wasn't, you know, doing it all the time, it was enough to raise the level of adrenaline in my brain, and most likely he thought was what had provoked the panic attack.
He didn't think it was the trauma that you'd been through as a war correspondent?
No, you know, it's an interesting, this is a bit of a tangent, but I'll sorry, give you a short answer on this one, but you know, I don't think what I experienced as a war correspondent would be classic trauma. I mean, I did, you know, obviously I there were some very hairy situations and I lost some friends, et cetera, et cetera. But my overarching response to being in a war zone, and you don't hear people talking about this that much, but it is the truth, is that I liked it.
Right.
Not in a sick way. You know, I didn't enjoy watching people suffer, but the exhilaration was addictive. And I think that when I got home, I missed the adrenaline. I was in withdrawal from the adrenaline, and my way of coping with it mindlessly was to give myself a synthetic squirt of adrenaline through drugs. And so that's kind of my analysis and the analysis of my shrink. You know, we have an expert on the line who may disagree, and I'm certainly open to other theories about
other viewpoints.
Well, no, I think, you know, it's a big picture, and I think the everything was kind of working together to get that, to get you where you got, and the journey after this is the most important thing about this story. We're going to talk a little bit about self-medication with Dr. Mark Albanese when we come back from the break. We're talking with Dan Harris, who's an award-winning correspondent at ABC, and he's the author of the new book 10% Happier. And Dr. Mark Albanese is in the house with us.
That's right.
In the house with us. Dr. Albanese is a friend of Right Turns and also a friend of Right Turn Radios, and we love having him here. Dr. Albanese he teaches at Harvard Medical School, and he's co-author of the book Understanding Addiction is Self-Medication: Finding Hope Between the Pain.
So Dan, so here you are. You've had this panic attack. A lot of people have seen you struggle. You get some help, but it began a journey, and part of it was because you became, you know, started doing research for television on religion. Can you talk about the beginning of your journey and, you know, starting to interview people and your cynical self?
Yeah, so this isn't some like neat, clean story where I have a panic attack, stop using drugs, and then my life, you know, and then discover meditation, and my life becomes a nonstop parade of unicorns and rainbows. it's kind of a windy road. I'll try to give you a shortened version, which is that around the time of the panic attack, I was assigned to cover religion for ABC News, but I grew up in the People's Republic of Massachusetts, and my parents are scientists at Harvard, actually, and so I was, you know, I had no interest in religion. I will say I did have a bar mitzvah, but only for the money. So this was not something that I wanted to cover. Peter Jennings, however, did not care. He said I was going to do it anyway, and it ended up being a great thing for me. I made a bunch of friends and you know, developed a real respect for people of faith, and realized how ignorant I was about a lot of this stuff, and developed also a real respect for the value of having a worldview that transcends your own narrow interests. That said, none of what I encountered spoke to me personally. Like I didn't go kosher or anything like that until several years into the beat. I stumbled upon a book by this guy Eckhart Tolle.
Yep.
Well, I'm sure you guys have heard of. I'm sure many of your listeners have heard of. I had not heard of him. He's a mega best-selling self-help guru. And he was the first person I ever heard talk about the voice in the head, by which he was not referring to schizophrenia or hearing voices, but to your internal narrator, the voice that, you know, scares you out of bed in the morning and is yammering at you all day long and has you constantly wanting stuff or not wanting stuff or you know, judging other people, criticizing yourself very harshly. Here's one of the hallmarks, thinking about the past or the future instead of focusing on whatever's happening right now. And, you know, Tolle's thesis is that when you're unaware of this nonstop conversation, it yanks you around.
Right.
It's why you're, you know, eating when you're not hungry or losing your temper when it's not in your best interest or checking your phone when your kid's trying to talk to you. And so that was a huge aha moment for me, because I realized the voice, first of all, I realized that this was just an intuitively true diagnosis of the human condition, and two, I realized that the voice was why I had, you know, engaged in this cascade of mindless behavior that resulted in the panic attack, you know, going to the war zones without thinking about it, getting getting back here and getting depressed without really knowing it, and then blindly self-medicating. So that really got me interested. I'll stop there and see what your next question is.
You're good at this.
You know, I've told the story once or twice before.
Yes, we've seen some of them. But, I mean, one of the things I was wondering is, now that you kind of have looked at religion, do you then decided, you started looking for the self healing yourself? And there was, I mean, the book is great, first of all. Everybody should buy it, because it's such a wonderful, gentle way of walking people through it. What was kind of your process in looking towards this kind of more meditative side? And what were some of the things you did?
Well, when I read that book by Tolle, like, my hair was on fire. You know, I was so interested. I never heard anybody describe being a human in this way, even though, you know, it's kind of like thunderously obvious. But,
well, he's an amazing guy, and I mean, he talks about his total ability to let go of anything except the present.
Right, unless if you believe him.
Yeah.
So I mean, I'm not the kind of person who just inclined to just take that at face value. He may be telling the truth, but we just don't have any way to know. And I have to say, you know, I went and interviewed him, and, you know, he's a very nice man, and I don't think he's, you know, full of it or anything like that. But, you know, I really pressed him for actionable advice for dealing with the voice in the head, and I came away very frustrated because, for example, I said, point blank, what do you do about the voice in the head? And his answer was, take one conscious breath. What the hell does that mean? I had no idea what that means. I still don't know what that means. And it went on like this for a while. And, you know, he went on to tell me that he never gets in a bad mood ever, and that he lived in a state of bliss on park benches in London for 2 years after having a spiritual awakening.
Right, a
sudden
moment.
I'm not
an
expert, but I think they have winter in London.
And it rains a lot.
So, you know, he may be telling the truth. I don't know. But my point is, my real beef is that I couldn't squeeze any sort of advice out of him. And it wasn't until I stumbled upon Buddhism.
Via Mark Epstein.
A very simple, concrete set of things you can do, that I ended up getting interested in meditation. And by the way, I should be honest about this. I was not, as you can probably tell from just hearing me talk briefly, I'm not a, I'm a little bit skeptical just by nature. And, you know, my view of meditation was quite dim. I thought it was only for weirdos and freaks and people who live in a yurt and are really into aromatherapy. And
yes, crunchy
even.
Granola
and,
types.
Yeah, and wear little finger symbols and make dream catchers.
Yeah.
Use the word namaste unironically.
Dr. Albanese, I'm interested in knowing, like, what's the brain process of this? People, to a certain extent, more or less everybody has something like this going on. Why do some people have more of it? What's happening in our brains?
Well, I don't know. We know totally. But by the way, Dan, thank you for sharing the story. I think it's going to be very helpful to so many people.
Thank you.
But I mean, I think, you know, probably our best understanding is that, the drugs of abuse tend to kind of excite the dopamine pathway in the brain, the so-called reward pathway. And it sounds like, actually, for you, Dan, that the what was addicting was really the excitement of being in those war zones, and in fact, it turns out that it's not just drugs of abuse, but it's also the things we enjoy doing that tend to make that dopamine, that reward pathway, light up. So shopping will do it, eating stuff you like will do it, God knows sex will do it. So any of those things will kind of get the dopamine pathway going. The interesting thing is that, we're talking about meditation, and that makes me think of balance. I mean, the reality is that the body tends to want to be in balance. Mm. And Dan described the adrenaline that kind of got going. And the reality is the body starts pumping out the adrenaline as a way, really, of dealing with the the overexcited dopamine. So it's this yin yang thing going on where there's a real effort to kind of balance what's out of balance, and the problem is that then that gets kind of out of whack itself.
So we're talking about anxiety, we're talking about monkey mind, we're talking about ways to moderate that, and ultimately using meditation was part of the answer for Dan Harris. You're listening to Right Turn Radio. We're going to be back right after this break. Our guest is ABC correspondent Dan Harris, who is the author of the new book, 10% Happier, How I Tamed the Voice in My Head, Reduced Stress Without Losing My Edge, and Found Self-Help That Actually Works, A True Story. And also is Dr. Mark Albanese, who is the co-author of Understanding Addiction as Self-Medication, Finding Hope Behind the Pain. So you're on this journey. We want to know, let's get to the meat of the matter. How did you discover and when did you start adopting meditation, Dan?
Well, after I interviewed Eckhart Tolle and walked away a little bit unsatisfied, I ended up kind of nosing around in the self-help world a little bit, which in my view is a pretty grim place filled with questionable types who will tell you that you can solve all of your problems through the power of positive thinking, which is, I think, a really destructive message. One night, at wit's end, I came home and my wife gave me a gift, which was a book by a psychiatrist in New York City named Dr. Mark Epstein, who writes about the overlap between psychology and Buddhism, Freudian psychology and Buddhism. And I actually, despite the fact that I was ostensibly a religion reporter, didn't really know anything about Buddhism, other than the fact that when I was a punk kid in Newton, Massachusetts at age 15, I had stolen a Buddha statue from a local gardening store and put it in my bedroom.
So you were an expert.
And you know, when I started reading this doctor's book, I realized that all of the stuff I liked the most about Tolle was right there in the Buddha, you know, 2,500 years before Tolle started cashing his royalty checks. It was the dude heretofore known to me only as a lawn ornament who was talking about the voice in the head. He called it the monkey mind. You know, he had a very clear prescription, which was this meditation thing. As we discussed earlier, I didn't want to do it. But then I did a little bit more research, and I found that there's been an explosion of science into the benefits of meditation. It's still very much in its early stages, but nonetheless strongly suggestive of a long list of health benefits, everything from lowering your blood pressure to boosting your immune system to reducing release of the stress hormone cortisol. And some of the neuroscience is really just sci-fi. And there was a study at Harvard, for example, in 2011, I believe 2011, that showed that, you know, novice meditators, people who had never meditated before, did short daily doses of it over the course of 8 weeks. They were literally they were rewiring their brains, parts of the brain associated with self-compassion and self-awareness and compassion. The gray matter literally grew, and the area associated with stress, the gray matter literally shrank.
Well,
so
also, and
when I realized that, and I also realized that meditation is, you know, doesn't revolve believing in anything or sitting in a funny position or joining a group or wearing any special outfits, that it's a pretty secular, straightforward brain exercise, I decided to give it a shot, and it's made a big difference.
And I mean, you also in your journey, you found it in the most unlikely places.
Oh, meditation, for
yeah.
Sure. You know, I mean, I think we're really at the beginning of a public health revolution, and there's a lot of evidence to back that rather sweeping statement up, because meditation is now being done at major corporations like Google, Twitter, Aetna, Procter & Gamble, General Mills, Target. It's being done by entertainers, everybody from the Katy Perry to the lead singer of Weezer to 50 Cent. That dude got shot 9 times. He deserves a little peace of mind. It's being done by athletes, the Seattle Seahawks, who won the Super Bowl. They have a meditation coach, Novak Djokovic, won Wimbledon, meditator. A lot of Olympians are doing it. It's also now being done in the U.S. Army and the U.S. Marines.
I thought that was amazing.
Yeah, they're spending millions of dollars to research whether meditation can make more effective and more resilient troops who are less prone to PTSD. So, yeah, it's really starting to take off in very interesting places, and I think that's because it's because of the science. You know,
it's simple and it works.
And it's cheap. Costs nothing,
but nobody's making any money on it.
Dan, yeah. I'm wondering what your meditation looks like. What is it? Do you do it daily? Is there a schedule around it? How does it exist in your world?
Yeah, well, it might be useful to define meditation mm-hmm. because the word is a bit like sports. It describes a whole range of activities. But what I'm talking about is something called mindfulness meditation, which is so simple that I explained it once to the tech reporter at the New York Times in fewer letters than it takes to send a tweet. So I'll just give you the short, a slightly longer version, but still short. Three steps. The first step is, by the way, you don't have to do this, especially if you're driving, don't do it. But just so you know, the first step is to sit with your eyes closed and your spine straight. The second step is to just try to focus your full attention on the feeling of your breath coming in and going out. Pick a spot where you feel the breath most prominently. Usually that's your belly or your nose or your chest. Just try to feel it coming in and going out. Every time you do this, your mind is going to go nuts. You're going to start thinking about, why did I say that dumb thing to my boss? What am I going to have for dinner? Why did Dances with Wolves beat Goodfellas for Best Picture in 1991? whatever. And that's fine. That is just the nature of the mind. And the whole game is when you've gotten lost in thought to notice you're lost and to start over and then do it again mm-hmm. and then do it again and then do it again. And every time you do that, it's a bicep curl for your brain and it shows up on those brain scans. It is also, by the way, a radical act because you're breaking a lifetime habit of walking around in a fog of projection into the future and rumination about the past, and you are instead focusing on what's happening right now. And I think 5 to 10 minutes a day of this is enough to really change the relationship between you and that voice in your head. It puts enough distance between you and that voice so that when the voice in your head offers up a terrible suggestion, which, by the way, is its job pretty
That's
much.
That's right. There's a lot of bad suggestions.
Yeah, so you might be able to better resist it at least 10% of the time. And that's a pretty good return on investment.
Can you give us an example, a recent example, where you were able to kind of avert mental disaster or some issue in your life that meditation made it better?
I'm better able at giving you examples of where I failed.
Okay, sure.
Just yesterday, I had a conversation with my boss that I've been wondering whether I need to call him and apologize about. I don't like when people put themselves out there as avatars of perfection. Because I think, I think that then people think, I can't do what this guy's talking about. So I still make a lot of mistakes. And I like to joke that, if my wife were on the line, she'd give you the 90% still a moron.
If 10% is better?
What'd you say?
10% is better?
Yeah, 10% is definitely better. And there's no question about it. And look, I don't want to sell myself short. It is definitely true that with being more mindful, and we haven't defined that term, but I'm not sure we have time for it, but basically being more self-aware, I can feel a starburst of self-righteous thoughts. I can feel an onrush of anger earlier and more in a more clear way than I used to, and I'm better at not taking the bait and acting on it.
Yeah.
And that means that I am better at not saying that stupid, impulsive thing that's going to ruin my marriage for the next 45 minutes. Mm-hmm. Not always, but a lot of the time. And also, I work in a very high-stress environment where I have other people's voices literally piped into my ear all the time.
And we have it right now. Yeah.
And so I am just better at being calm when I need to. Again, that is not to say that I'm never a jerk, because I am. It's just that I'm less of a jerk.
So I want to say thank you for joining us. And people need to read the book because the last few chapters kind of about the emotional growth and the spiritual growth that he went through is great. So,
Dan, thanks so much for your time today. Thanks for sharing your journey with us and kind of opening this topic up to the general public, because I think it's getting out there. People are talking about it. Dan Harris is co-anchor of ABC News' Nightline and the weekend edition of Good Morning America. He's the author of the new book, 10% Happier. We'll be back to Right Turn Radio after a break. Thank you so much. We're talking about anxiety, monkey mind, as it says in Buddhism, and meditation. And it, you know, this is a salve for a lot of different things. What we deal with, Abby, is addiction and recovery. So we use meditation and mindfulness and relaxation techniques for people in early recovery, but also as far as long-term treatment for the stuff that the root causes, which Dr. Albanese can speak to, of addiction. And I'd like you to talk a little bit about, you know, the idea of self-medication and how people find a path out of that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, Dan's story really is very much in line with what the bulk of the research shows. You know, here's a man who, you know, is in a pretty kind of precarious life situation, namely a war zone. Comes home, you know, without that excitement. He, you know, kind of has issues with depression, and then finds that, a nice antidote to that is, in fact, cocaine. And in fact, most of the data when you look at the big population studies, people who have a problem with cocaine, who also have some kind of emotional problem like depression or anxiety, more often than not, the emotional problems, so that depression, anxiety, in cases of some people, it's post-traumatic stress disorder, whatever it is, more often than not, the that problem, the emotional problem, predates the onset of the use of cocaine. So, you know, Dan's story is actually, you know, a familiar one from that perspective. I think that, what's wonderful, and you know, the subtitle of the book that Ed and I wrote is Finding Hope Behind the Pain. And I think, you know, I think Dan's story is one of hope, right? I mean, he overcomes the cocaine thing and the panic and the anxiety and has found a way to kind of make his life right, so to speak. And I think that's really what our work is in addiction treatment is, you know, it goes beyond helping people just stop using the drug or doing the behavior, you know, gambling or whatever. It really is about addressing the other chaos in their lives, you know, the disturbed relationships, the problems with self-esteem, the emotional dysregulation, the deficits in taking care of themselves. And, you know, for Dan, it's for a lot of people, it's meditation. But certainly, you know, I've worked with people as you guys have, who have benefited from other changes, you know, to their lives. The connection, the fellowship of 12-step, for example.
Religion. I mean, religion, prayer,
sure.
Works for
right.
Some people.
Yep.
Exercise.
Uh-huh.
Any kind of connection, social connection is often a powerful thing.
Well, it's really interesting because we always have in this segment, like, the hope and here's what works. And the same stuff always works, no matter what the problem is coming in to get yourself back, your, you know, recovery of self. You know, if it's a mental health issue, if it's a substance abuse issue, if it's a your life's overwhelming issue, you were saying before, you have to get balanced.
Yep.
You have to find the balance so your brain stops, like, fighting with itself. You have to, and it's all the, you know, I mean, all of these things are trying to get a positive voice in your head. You know, for what, you know, either, you know, getting God to talk to you, or the 12 steps reminding you that, you know, you can get away. You know, you might have messed up, but it's over.
And, yeah.
You know, it's...
And it doesn't, you know, these things don't come at a huge cost. I mean, the good stuff you can do doesn't come at a huge cost. You know, you were, you know, my mother, who lived through the Depression, likes to say that, you know, the best things in life are free. And, you know, there's wisdom to that.
Well, we're finding out more and more, and I use it at Right Turn every day, is mindfulness is a powerful thing. And Dan was talking about it, because as soon as you can recognize these thoughts.
Mindfulness?
Mindfulness is just recognize. It's exactly how it sounds, recognizing this thing. There's that thought again. There's my negative perseveration, or there's the positive, what, you know, there's, I'm pulling something positive, some, you know, there's gratitude again, and just seeing it, observing it, sometimes stepping back and observing it and recognizing it and putting it in a place and saying, I can still exist, using the tools, you know, that you have, meditation, whatever it is, but using them to contextualize that stuff instead of them being so damaging to the self.
Well, it's a weird way of hearing those inner voices without listening to
them.
Right. It's like you get this distance. It's like you can, like kids do, they're really good at hearing things and not listening. We have a lot to learn from them.
Husbands are pretty good at that too.
I don't even know if they hear.
But I mean, this is, you know, and the science is, you know, that he alluded to is fascinating behind it. But like Mark said, we are finding that some of these interventions are so simple, anybody can adopt them. They're so helpful. I remember seeing Phil Jackson, the very successful basketball coach, talk about how meditation had really changed his life and saved him from the stress of working in the NBA, and seeing how he shared that with some of his most successful athletes that he worked with, and they went on to be proponents of it. So it's something that's simple. You know, people think, my mind's too busy to meditate, and the people who are really successful at it say their mind's the same way, and a few times, and you'd be surprised how easy it comes.
Well, and we all kind of talk about how there are all these wonderful opportunities. People should go home and try this.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Sitting in traffic
with a 10-minute timer in a comfortable chair without anybody bugging you, and see what it's like, and just watch it, and read his description in the book. It's amazing that the 10 days he took off to do it was just incredible.
It's incredible. There's nothing ever that's bad that's going to come from meditation. It's, and there's a lot of interventions like meditation that Mark, you know, that you've seen in your practice, I'm sure, and that evidence-based treatment for addiction really has adopted a lot of that stuff.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about the relationship that somebody has with an addictive substance as a relationship, you know, what's the antidote to that? It's substituting a healthy relationship, right? So whether it's with a exercise like meditation, or just, you know, the fellowship that people find and self-help. But that's the way I like to think about the process.
So we'd like to thank Dr. Mark Albanese.
Thank you, Mark.
For coming.
Always
again
a pleasure.
To Right Turn Radio. We love having him here. And you can buy his book online. The book is Understanding Addiction is Self-Medication, Finding Hope Behind the Pain.
Thank you, Mark.
You've been listening to the Right Turn Radio podcast. Check us out at right-turn.org. I'm John Cohan.
And I'm Abby Dean. Remember, be safe and ask for help.